Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we try to bring you something very, very special and something from the depths of our hearts. And that thing is called This Week in Music History. And of course, to help me along with this project is Jacob Crum.
You can't roller skate in a buffalo herd.
Yes, I can. And of course, the man who also does and has done numerous times, Greg Harvey.
Hello.
Greg, can you roller skate in a herd of buffalo?
Depends on if it was on concrete or grass. I need like a smooth surface.
Little known fact, our beloved Greg Harvey here is very much into roller derby.
Yeah.
And he's quite good from what I understand.
It's made me a pretty good skater. I think I could hang with a buffalo herd.
So, moving on with this episode, of course, if you want to help us out to where we don't have to make Greg go out and roller skate with a herd of buffalo.
And don't shoot me from a train either.
You can help us out by going to followthesoundpodcast.com and clicking on the Amazon banner on the side of the page. From there, it takes you to Amazon. You can do all of your normal shopping, and it won't cost you anything extra, but we get a little bit of money for every purchase that you make, just as sort of like a referral. But like I said, it doesn't cost you anything extra, so it's no more expensive. Just you got to take a couple extra seconds and go through our website. So go to our website, followthesoundpodcast.com, click on the Amazon banner, or go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. All right, folks, let's get into This Week in Music History. We are starting with September 11th, ending on September 15th. We got some interesting things to talk about. But of course, before we really get into music history, I just wanted to say this. Of course, we all remember 9/11. We know exactly where we all were during 9/11. We know exactly the impact that it had on our culture. And it did have some vast impacts on the music industry even, and lots and lots of stuff. But we're not going to talk about that in extreme detail because that's just not what our show is. But we know that those people are still mourning the losses of their family members, their loved ones, of those firefighters and police officers who risked their lives and lost their lives. And we just wanted to say that in our own weird, small way, we still mourn the loss of those American lives. It was a sad day in history in general. But let's actually get into the real music history that we have to present to you starting on September 11th. And of course, we talked about Rock Around the Clock a little bit ago, a few months ago, I believe. But in 1956, police were called to break up a crowd of rowdy teenagers following a showing of the movie Rock Around the Clock at the Trocadero Cinema in London, England. The following day, the Times printed a reader's letter that said, "The hypnotic rhythm and wild gestures have a maddening effect on a rhythm-loving age group, and the result of its impact is the relaxing of all self-control." The film was then banned in several British cities.
Mm-hmm. To try and make it sound like everybody was just peeing their pants when they heard
the
song.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Like, were the theaters in London not prepared for the epic shit stains?
It was a major hygiene
from people
issue.
Relaxing all self-control?
Everybody is just relaxing all over the place. What a mess.
This is going to make people go out and have sexual relations. We can't have that.
These people
are British people.
I don't know what that voice is.
I don't know. That was just me doing this stupid stuck-up person.
I think you should make it a theme.
And then in 1960...
The problem is, I can do a British accent if I actually hear the accent and then I can parrot it, but I can't just do one off the top of my head. Not without mm-hmm. it sounding really dumb.
Oh well,
Jimmy. So.
I find when I ask British people, not like entertainers or someone who does it for a living, but just a person from England, it doesn't matter where from, really doesn't. Could be Manchester, could be Leeds, doesn't matter. If I tell them, all right,
Croydon,
well, yeah, 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 Camden by the Sea or Clacton on the Sea. Clacton on the Sea. If I tell them, like, just do an American accent for me, it's always like a New Yorker guy who's angry about.
I think,
like,
I hear
everything.
A lot of, like,
hey,
Texas.
Hey, I come
ones.
From Croydon.
Yeah. Or if I ask a woman to do it, it's always a Valley girl. Always.
I could see. You want to know? I don't know why I'm going on this weird tangent. Yeah. But apparently in England, if you ask somebody to do an American accent, mm-hmm. what they will probably do is California or Southern.
I've always gotten someone who's like, hey, what's the deal, buddy?
Because, like, the New York one, like, apparently yeah. isn't the first one that pops in their head, but apparently it's a lot easier for them to do Southern than it is to do a lot of others.
Right, because that's what British people sounded like 200 years ago.
Yes, exactly.
It's Southern. Almost like they say things that a New Yorker would say, but with a Southern accent. So it's like, hey there, buddy.
Hey, I'm walking here. I'm walking here, buddy.
Yeah, that is actually it, though. That was pretty good, Brian. It's funny that we can do American British accents. We're so talented.
Yo, it's like Inception over here. 1960.
Go for it.
Nancy Sinatra weds Tommy Sands in what was the celebrity couple at the time.
Now, wait, Tommy Sands. Is that any relation to the Sands Hotel?
No, that's okay. Just the Sands Hotel.
Okay, because no, Nancy Sinatra, yes, I figured yeah. Frank, you know,
fair
Vegas
enough.
Thing. So.
Fair enough. We'll get into that.
I thought that would be an interesting connection.
It would Vegas. Be, especially since we have a story about that later.
That is true.
Anyhow.
But that's all I got for Nancy Sinatra marrying
somebody. That's pretty
somebody.
Much all there was. You
really
think
care.
People were upset when Justin and whatever the heck her name was.
Who? That one girl?
Yeah.
Shows you how much I pay attention.
Yeah, whatever. That was like 3 years ago, right?
Yeah, that girl.
Yeah, you think people were upset then? 1960, man, when they split. 65 when they split. Ooh, buddy. Anyhow.
All right, 1962, after George Martin insisted that session drummer Andy White took Ringo Starr's place. What was up with him, man? Like, everybody was trying to get rid of the Beatles drummers. It's like, if it wasn't Brian Epstein, it was George Martin. The Beatles returned to EMI Studios in London for the third attempt at recording their first single, Love Me Do, which was selected as the Beatles' first A-side, with P.S. I Love You as the B-side. And that was actually supposed to be reversed from that originally. But the single was released on October 5th, and it featured a version of Love Me Do with Ringo on the drums. But the album, Please Please Me, included the version with Andy White on the drums.
Oh, buddy. So all you Ringo fans out there, run out and get your singles.
The funny thing is, I honestly couldn't tell you. Really? I couldn't tell you which one was which unless I legitimately had them both played next to
back
each
to
other.
Back to back.
Yeah. And then I'd be able to tell the difference on who was who, because Ringo did have kind of a distinctive style, but he also could not do that if the song required it. So, like, I could probably pick up on that, but at the same time, I mean, it was a very weird time for the Beatles because, mm-hmm. you know, it's like Pete Best is on some of the recordings for some of the stuff.
Yeah.
It's like Ringo's on other ones. Apparently Andy White's on another one. It's like, guys, just they couldn't lock down a drummer at that point until they finally did. But
I have to be honest, I don't know the intricacies and subtleties of bebop rhythm sections.
There you go.
So there you are.
1965, Moby is born. Richard Melville Hall. In Harlem, New York.
Yeah.
How do you get the name Moby?
If we were Moby fans, we'd probably be able to answer that.
I'm sure there's probably some Moby fan like listening to the show just screaming at us right now. It was because he was such a huge fan of Moby Dick as a child.
You guys are the worst music podcast ever.
How dare you?
You don't know any of these artists. Also, born on this day, except 2 years later after Moby, Harry Connick Jr.
Star, actor, singer, American Idol judge.
And a junior.
Harry Connick Jr., of course, is fantastic. An extremely talented jazz musician and jazz singer. He was huge in rebuilding parts of the French Quarter after Katrina. Just plays all over the world. And, of course, is very well known for being the dude who did the stupid maneuver in Independence Day and got himself killed. But, of course, he was also really, really good in Memphis Belle, which is what I remember him from. He was the tail gunner. and the piano player who played O Danny Boy.
Of course.
Happy birthday, Harry Connick Jr.
Happy, yeah, birthday.
And Moby.
And on the very same day.
But we got to move on.
Yes. So while Harry Connick Jr. is being born, and we've already mentioned that Frank Sinatra had his stage show hosted at the Sands Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, right?
Yes.
So, the year, 1967, the place, the Sands Casino. The man, Frank Sinatra, is gambling, as he's wanted to do. However, the Sands had recently been bought by new owners, and as such, Frank was denied credit at the table, and he did not take to this new policy very well. Eventually, the dealer called over security, and Frank took a swing at security. 5 minutes later, and two of Frank's teeth later, he's dragged out of the Sands Casino. Not long after Frank broke contract with the Sands, he wanted to leave so badly he gave them money and moved over to Caesar's Palace. How did that work out? Well, Caesar's Palace, still around. The Sands, not so much.
You be the judge.
I will say this too. Caesar's Palace has like the best buffet in Vegas.
Really?
It's called the Bacchanal.
Not Circus Circus.
It's called the Bacchanal.
You're telling me.
It's like $60 and it's amazing. Hands down, amazing.
I bet they don't even have French toast sticks there.
I'm pretty sure they have like a ton of fried stuff at any given time. And they have Wagyu beef sliders.
Okay. Oh, real sliders. Because that's what I want.
Well, you can get like 15 of them if you want.
Yeah. When I think about hand massaged veal, what I want is sliders. I want it hand put on a really small bun.
Veal sliders.
I'm just saying. Ugh. One of the best.
Okay, then. Have you had Circus Circus's buffet?
I have not.
I'm told that's the one to get.
I'm told that's one of the cheap ones to get.
Yes.
Oh, I'm just Vegas. Saying. I usually just go to that Subway.
You will not find, like, if you look up any, like, top list of buffets in Vegas, Bacchanal will show up on each one of those lists.
And Circus Circus will
not. I wonder
if
Frank Sinatra started the buffet there.
I highly doubt it. But Caesar's Palace is actually a really cool place to go. They keep it really well organized, super cool layout for everything, and they're constantly updating, so they're not stuck in the past like a lot of other casinos were, which is exactly why they keep failing.
Yeah, Vegas.
But Caesars keeps going strong.
Vegas is like, there's no in between. It's like all old or all new, you know, and they're all right next to each other.
The old part of Vegas is actually really interesting to go to, though, because like that's where a lot of those guys originally were, like the Golden Nugget, you know, and the plaza and like all that on Fremont Street.
Yep.
Still just, it cracks me up because you walk in there like sometimes at night and it's just like, oh, wow, these people are like, these aren't the tourists. Like, these are the local people who want to go and gamble.
and drink outside in the
street. Yes.
Hey, go ahead. 1997, my boy.
77. Oh, if he was 97, he wouldn't be that old.
Did I say 97?
He said 97.
Oh, yeah. 1977, my boy, Luda. It's Ludacris, a.k.a. Chris Bridges, was born. My man. 2001, he had a UK number 10 single with Missy Elliott, 1 Minute Man. 2002, a US number 3 album, Word of Mouth. That's a good album, too.
So Ludacris actually played at Lou Fest, I believe, last year, and brought the house down.
Dude, Luda.
And on top of that, Ludacris, of course, stars in the most ludicrous car movies ever made, the Fast and Furious franchise. Oh, yeah.
Also in the.
But he is really funny in those movies, so I like watching him.
Ludacris, great actor, also was in the Academy Award winning movie Crash, which was fantastic.
That is true. Yes.
Very good movie. And he did a great job in that one, too.
How many Fast and Furious movies are we up to now?
Seven.
I thought we were on eight.
Well, seven was the posthumous Paul Walker one that they released that he was in.
Yeah.
So I guess, it would be eight now, technically.
Yeah,
the new one's the eight.
Because Fast 7 was the last one with him, so then they did eight, which he's not in at all.
You remember when it was just Too Fast, Too Furious?
I've never.
Tokyo Drift.
I've never seen any of them.
Really?
You're missing out, man.
Ludacris.
Great. I kind of feel right now that like there's no other place but space for cars to go. You know, like they did, like didn't they do in the ocean?
They did on like a frozen ocean area.
Yeah. So that's pretty close. So, I mean, and they've done underground.
They did an airstrip that was like 80 miles long. That was impressive.
Okay. Either, like space is kind of the final frontier for these movies. Wow. But either way, I mean, it's not like I'm a fan.
Yeah, so either way.
Happy birthday, Ludacris.
Let's bring it on back down to the ground, though. Ooh,
I do want to say, though, that I did work with Ludacris's aunt at one of my part-time jobs growing
up. There you go.
And she says that he sends her a check every year for Christmas time, and she buys all of her Christmas presents for her family from the check that Ludacris sends her to go out and buy presents, and I thought that
that's
was really
cool. That is pretty,
that's pretty
nice.
Baller.
Rumor has it, rumor has it he's originally from Champaign, Illinois, even though he represents Atlanta. So, just saying.
Yes. Somebody who represents more of the Nashville area by way of Georgia. Born on this day is, of course, American country music singer and solo artist, even though he is with a group most of the time, founding member of Lady Antebellum, Charles Kelly. Of course, their debut album included the trio's debut hit, Love Don't Live Here, along with the singles Looking for a Good Time and the massive, massive hit, I Run to You.
Oh, yeah.
So here's the thing. The one reason why I actually put this in here. One, or two reasons why I put this in here. One, I just recently saw Lady Antebellum when they came to St. Louis.
Yes.
It was the least country show I've ever been to. And I don't exactly know the best way I can. It was good music, good singing. Everything was cool. Everything was great. It was a good show, but it felt like I was watching a kid's show. Hmm. Like that's kind of what it felt like. It was very PG.
Well, they're kind of like a pop country group.
Yes. Yes. So, but on top of that, Charles Kelly is actually an amazing singer. And I know with some of the Lady Antebellum stuff, like it kind of gets, you know, it's the group of them. And so that's why they're famous, because it's the trio and like they do these really good harmony parts. And it's usually the girl who like is kind of on the forefront on a lot of these slower songs.
Yeah, like Need You Now.
Yes, yes. So but Charles Kelly released a solo album this last year, and it is honestly a really good album. It's not country like at all. It's more kind of like a soft rock kind of vein, but it's got some really good elements to it. And Charles Kelly just has this phenomenal voice that when he hits some of the high notes, just blows me away. Like it's kind of sad that he is not like just more well known as the individual that he is, but he's known exceptionally well for the Lady Antebellum stuff. So at least he's got that. But I wish his solo work was a lot more well known. So. Well, there you go. That's all I got for that one.
I like it.
Go ahead. Who's got the last one for this day?
Here we go. 1982. After more than 60 plus albums, Frank Zappa hits his only top 40 hit with Valley Girl, sung by his daughter Moon. Well, sung or spoken word by his daughter Moon. And if you want to know, Encino is like so bitchin'.
Moonbase Zappa.
I thought it was Moon's Unit.
Moon Unit Zappa. That's it. Yeah, Moon Unit Zappa.
Yeah, she was 14 at the time, and the song, like, first off, that song like started the whole Valley Girl thing. Like, people know that Valley Girls are a thing because that became the like go-to stupid woman voice. Mm. You know, like the go-to stupid guy voice is always Southern, or at least it is now.
Yeah,
At a time, like, you know, in Looney Tunes.
But at the same time, that SoCal, like, surfer guy.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true.
Like, it's like, dude, bruh, like.
Oh, bruh.
I was just going out there and catching some sick swirls, man.
I caught some gnarly waves, man.
Yeah,
it was
but
tubular.
You don't use the surfer dude voice when you're just talking about, like, anything else.
Yeah, if you're going to go for like an idiot, it's going to be like,
right.
Well, I'm just a country bumpkin.
Right, like if you're doubting people that like smart cars for some reason, it's not like, oh, like those smart cars are so small, how can you drive in them? It's like, man, them smart cars is too small, they ought to everybody run over you.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right.
I'm just saying.
Or people who deny science.
As the good boy Jeff Foxworthy stated, you know, Southern folks are great with their accents and their charm. He said, but at the same time, you do not want to hear your doctor come in and say, well, now, look, what your problem is here is...
Problem is here is you haven't been praying 15 times a day.
That's not true.
you
went too far with that.
All out of cattywampus.
I thought we were doing like the Southern like
no.
Baptist.
No.
Your heart, Greg, is all
Southern doctors. Southern doctors
are
our farm.
What we're going to do here is we're going to come in and we're going to keep it from going cattywampus by putting a stent in artery.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to spread
so they
some
know
of their snake
stuff.
Oil over
I'd like
the
to
wound.
Point out, they do know their stuff. Mm-hmm. It's was, not like Southern listen, doctors are worse. They're
Ryan,
not.
There was nothing I said there that was incorrect.
That
I
is true.
I just used the word cattywampus and rinky-dink.
That is true.
Which is not a term you really want a doctor to tell you, I don't think.
That is true.
Anyhow, all right.
We're going to put
I thought it was clever.
That was clever.
Thank you.
Just I a like little that. Bit of Windex on your dermatitis
on story. I mean... We got four more days to get through.
That is true.
Okay.
That is true.
Yes.
Moving on up to September 12th, 1944, the great and powerful Barry White is born in Galveston, Texas.
Barry Eugene Carter.
Yes.
I just always like to throw in like people.
The real name?
Yeah, like the stage name. It's just.
I just, can't get enough for
just,
you.
Just so that everybody knows who you're not talking about.
Yes.
And who you are talking about.
We talked about him. Last week,
yes,
2 weeks ago, sorry, 2 weeks ago, about his lovely time in prison
yeah.
for stealing 300 tires?
Something like that, yes.
300 tires.
Yeah.
There you go.
He kind of took a rap for, I think,
that's
a whole
true.
Lot
he probably
of people.
Did.
But anyway.
My darling.
Gotta love you, Barry White. Happy birthday.
Dude, this,
can't get enough of your love,
This
baby.
Next birthday is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Go for it.
Okay. 1952, born on this day. Neil Peart.
What?
The professor on the drum kit from the great Canadian rock band Rush. You may be familiar with their 1980 UK number 13 single Spirit of the Radio, which is actually my favorite song of all time. They had 82 US number 21 single with New World Man. Of course, countless other hits.
Tom Sawyer.
Tom Sawyer. Today's Tom Sawyer. Get on you. Neil Peart was actually made an officer of the Order of Canada.
Yes, he was.
On May 9th, 1996. And of course, the trio Rush was the first rock band to be so honored as a group.
And then the thing I love about not only is Neil like just one of the greatest drummers in rock history, but he also like wrote all the lyrics for like all of Rush's songs. That's awesome.
Yeah. Let me throw this at you. What do you think is the weakest Rush song?
Probably one
there
I haven't
isn't
heard.
One.
Whatever I disagree.
They're all strong.
Whatever the weakest Rush song is probably a song I've never listened to.
I kind of feel like Limelight.
Really?
Yeah.
You're talking like their weakest hit.
Sure.
I mean, Limelight, I think, is the most mainstream played out one. Because you would say Tom Sawyer, but it's not. That's the thing. Because, I mean, it would be Tom Sawyer, but
well,
it can't be.
The thing is, like, with Tom Sawyer is that it's the song that is played that is, like, when used to reference Rush.
Yeah. It's kind of the iconic yet cliche.
Because it's
example.
Got that.
Yeah.
Like, it's. Yeah. So it's got that. It's that quintessential Rush song that they always play. It's like in any movie, if anybody ever talks about Rush, they play Tom Sawyer.
And that synth part, too, that Geddy Lee's playing with his foot. Yeah. Well, just that first open, that, you know, that first note where
yes,
it's just
yes.
that hard.
Yes, yes, yes. All right, moving on up. We got a plethora.
Plethora.
Of 1966's for September 12th.
Yes.
So, who wants to take the first one?
I'll take it.
You do it. Because I'll take the second. You take the third.
Okay.
Got no, it.
Neither of you two have enough respect for Mr. Miller to do this one. Because on this day in 1966, the Roger Miller Show debuted on NBC.
Boom.
National Broadcasting Corporation.
Roger Miller. Yes.
The greatest lyricist of the last century.
Okay.
I said it.
You said it.
I said it.
You said it.
Yes, I did.
Well,
and
Why don't you elaborate?
Elaborate, yeah. Jake.
All right. So Roger Miller is he's the greatest lyricist of the last century. I mean, Jesus Christ.
Enough said.
The guy can say an entire book worth of things with like three lines. He has the only Christmas song that's worth playing, right?
It says you.
Little toy trains. Little toy trains. Little toy tracks. Little boy toys coming from a sack. Carried by a man dressed in white and red. Little boy, don't you think it's time you were in bed? That right there is a Norman Rockwell painting in four damn lines.
Yeah, that's definitely what I think of when I think of Christmas songs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the other brilliant thing
about
that line.
See, I always think of the chipmunks, so.
The other brilliant thing about that line, and I've heard Roger Miller make this mistake himself, if you sing carried by a man dressed in red and white, you just change the last line to little boy, don't you think it's time to say goodnight? Boosh, there you go. Even if you screw it up, you got to rhyme.
You can fake it.
There you go.
You got plan B.
All right. Debuting either right after or right before, I'm not entirely sure.
I think it was before.
Before, NBC aired the first episode of The Monkees in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the series ran for a total of 58 wonderful episodes. And we have talked numerous times about doing a Monkees review here because we are big fans of The Monkees and their music. And I am looking forward to that. So check in the future for when we do that. We may have to like do it next
when
week.
When we review all 58 episodes individually.
Yeah. Well, now that would be fun. We could actually do that. Just record it on YouTube and go from there. Right. So.
Yeah. But I want you to think about this, though, just quickly. The Monkees in prime time. I want you to think about sitting down on like a Wednesday night.
More like primate time, am I right?
Am I right? Hey. At 6 p.m., right, you know, you got your TV dinner in front of you, and the Monkees come on. Like, to me, the Monkees is like a Saturday morning reruns thing. It's not an evening with the family experience.
Yeah, but how lighthearted. I mean, Monkees and Partridge Family and Brady Bunch. I know it's not all at the same time, but just it was everything.
Pretty
was
close. They're
so
within
campy.
Like 3 or 4 years of each other.
Yeah, just
because we did the Cow Sills, and that was 57, 58.
Yeah, yeah.
But just that delightfully campy nature, you know, and the nuclear family with their TV dinners around the television set.
All right.
That's what it means to me.
Now let's do the other 1966.
Well, another birthday, Mr. Ben Folds himself, the U.S. singer, songwriter, keyboard player, and the leader of Ben Folds 5, as well as his solo music. In 1997, he had a U.K. number 26 single, Battle of Who Could Care Less. One of my personal favorite Ben Folds ones would have to be Rockin' the Suburbs. He did that as a solo song, but that was a good one. Ben Folds and Ben Folds 5. Also, Brick's a good one. She's a brick and I'm
They're all good ones, and I don't think that I have yet to find a karaoke that has One Angry Dwarf and 200 Solemn Faces.
I could probably fix that for you, buddy.
Could you? Because I think that that's the best lyric one to bring up in a karaoke.
All right.
Like, why do you have Brick? It's so sad. Anyway,
weirdly enough, weirdly enough, though, the one strange thing I know about Ben Folds, very big into a cappella music, which is why he was cast as a judge on the show The Sing-Off, which featured a cappella groups from around the country competing against each other.
Yeah, I think I do remember
so
seeing some
Ben Folds was actually very much involved in his a cappella choir, like, back in his college days.
You know, I will say, I think Ben Folds, he kind of reminds me of Beck in a sense that, like, a really talented musician who just doesn't get enough credit.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways.
All right, let's move on to 1990. Stevie Nicks and Christine McVie from Fleetwood Mac announced that they were leaving the band at the end of their current tour. At the time, some believed that Nicks and McVie's departures were hastened by the bad blood in the wake of Mick Fleetwood's memoir, Fleetwood, My Life and Adventures in Fleetwood Mac, which revealed some sordid revelations about life in Fleetwood Mac.
And adventures.
I'm just saying. It was, I'm pretty sure Jessica has this book somewhere on our bookshelf. So it would be interesting to actually go through it. But apparently he did say some things that were quite controversial. Mm-hmm. And so the two ladies were just like, that's it. I think I'm done with this. But it was shortly after that that Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham came back and started playing with Fleetwood Mac due to Bill Clinton reuniting them for his inauguration.
Yes. Yeah.
So I don't remember if Christine actually played with them. I think she did, but I could be mistaken. My wife would be able to tell you. But what I do know is that Christine then took a very long leave from the band.
Mm-hmm.
And but now she is back with the group and now touring with Lindsey when they released a duet album that they produced together. So It's called Buckingham McVie.
Yeah.
So it's a good album. We'll have a listen to it. And I'm looking forward to seeing them when they come to town. So
anyway, reuniting Fleetwood Mac was the best thing that the Clinton presidency produced.
That is true. Very much true. Now let's move into a day of national mourning.
A day of darkness.
All right, I'll take it
Go
away.
Go for it.
2003, the great, the legendary, the man, Johnny Cash, dies of respiratory failure at age 71 following complications from heart disease and diabetes. Of course, he is possibly the most influential man in country music.
That is true.
One of the most influential people in rock music.
That is absolutely true.
Known as the man in black because he can. Johnny Cash.
I do like the fact that he always started his shows with, "Hello, I'm Johnny Cash."
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a sad one. I mean, Johnny Cash, because, like, it's funny when I was looking at the year 2003 that he died,
mm-hmm.
and one of the first things I thought of because I saw 2003 was then I thought of his cover of Hurt, Nine Inch Nails.
Which is honestly brilliant.
And haunting.
Yeah.
Very haunting.
And, I mean, that was like his swan song, but it wasn't, you know?
That whole album is really good. If you haven't heard, like, what else is on it, he's got some other covers, and there's a gospel cover he does of God's Gonna Cut You Down.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The music video for that is amazing.
Really?
Yeah, because they got all of these other, like actors mm-hmm. or like musicians and stuff, and basically it's them listening to it and singing along to it, but you don't hear their voices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like Kris Kristofferson, I mean, just everyone, and mm-hmm. it's really the swan song.
Heck, like
the swan song.
Kris rocks
for
in that song,
yeah.
Like in that video.
Yeah,
like just all these people who just had mad respect for Johnny Cash, and wanted to basically pay tribute to his life by being in that music video. It's amazing. It's honestly a great music video.
Was it? I Walked the Line. Was that the
movie
biopic that they made?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that was really good. And that really kind of introduced the wider range of what Johnny Cash really went through in his career mm-hmm. to me. And of course, you know, I think it's part of our generation too, that when movies come out, we're more inclined to see those.
You know, when I was a kid, like I remember seeing Johnny Cash on TV. And it was really like Daddy Sing Bass, Mama Sing a Tenor, kind of like, you know, TV shows, campy. And it felt so weird and out of touch from everything else that I knew. You know, like, it was still on, like, it reruns in the 90s. So I didn't get Johnny Cash. And then until I was in a some record store and I saw the poster of him giving the finger to the camera.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, what is going on? And I just started looking through his albums and I saw Folsom Prison Blues sitting in there, and I'm like, he played at a prison? I didn't know that was a thing. Like, I thought people went to prison and they were just away. I didn't know they were still people.
Yeah, so, like having concerts and stuff.
Yeah. So I went, and sure enough, it was in the you know, the little booth where you can listen to stuff. They had Folsom Prison Blues in it, and I was just completely blown away. I'm like, you can hear the jail cells closing. It's so real.
Wow. Yeah.
So the thing that I also loved, you talked about that poster of him giving the middle finger.
Yeah.
So when he teamed up with Rick Rubin, like as Johnny Cash's career was basically dead at that point, and he teamed up with Rick Rubin and like got him to record a bunch of these albums and stuff like that. But when he got nominated and won a Grammy Award, Rick Rubin took out a full page ad.
Yeah.
And it was just Johnny Cash giving the finger as the picture. And I was like, Yes, that was such a Johnny Cash thing to do, even though Johnny Cash didn't actually do it. But there, like, Rick Rubin was one of those people who just flat out knew that this was a man who still had something to say in his music, and he was so freaking right.
I think my favorite tribute to Johnny Cash, though, is actually a monument at Emo's, a nightclub in Austin, Texas.
Not the pizza joint in St. Louis.
Not the pizza joint in St. Louis. It's with an E, not with an I. And Johnny Cash played one show there somewhere in, like, I don't know, around 2000.
Yeah.
And they had him sign the stool that he sat on, and they bolted the stool above the bar. You walk in and you just see a big red seat cushion with Johnny Cash, huge, like 12-inch signature on it.
Hmm.
Wow.
There you go.
There are literally just thousands of Johnny Cash stories that people could tell. That just each one, just a little point on how he was influential into the music world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still amazing to me that after all this time, to this day, he is still just being credited with so much stuff and being so influential that I honestly don't think that his influence will die down for another 100 years.
Yeah.
I think it'll take 3 generations removed from him before it's finally gone.
I think, like, Ring of Fire,
and not even gone. Not even gone, just, like, before it's faded, like, from everyone else is here today.
Actually, speaking of Ring of Fire, that's one of those songs that it got so big that it became a joke of itself, too, in a way.
Yeah.
Because that one, because it has, I remember, like, just growing up and there was always punchlines was Ring of Fire and Preparation H and, you know, you put one and one together, things like that. Anyways. That's how I segue every
time. Wow.
Anyways.
I'll close it out with this, that Johnny Cash, you know, while he wasn't a massive influence in my life necessarily before he died, he was a massive influence after, because that's when I really found his music. And it was because of the music video for Hurt that I went back and started listening to all of those other songs that he made. And so it's just one of those things where, yeah, it didn't impact me. I'd heard Johnny Cash songs growing up, you know, on the radio and stuff, but nothing actually hit me until finally later on. And then when it did, I did exactly what our show is, and I followed the sound, and now he's become just a massive influence on my life. I will never be able to sing like him. I will never be able to write like him. I'll never be able to play guitar like him. But at the same time, he was such a big impact on me just with his sheer grit and determination to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish in the music industry. And I loved it. It was brilliant. So Johnny Cash, you will be missed, at least by us, for a very, very long time. Another person we will miss.
Yes.
Is 2013, another sad day in music history. Ray Dolby, the engineer and inventor behind Dolby Sound, died of leukemia at the age of 80 in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Or as Spinal Tap would say, record it in Dubly.
In Dubly, yes.
So everybody knows Dolby, like, from the, you know, Dolby surround sound, yeah, 5.0, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But Dolby was an interesting fellow in and of himself.
Yeah.
Because, like, he would just do weird things in the recording studios just to see what it actually sounded like. Like, he once put up, like, a row of, like, 30 speakers just to see what the sound would actually sound like with 30 speakers pointing in one direction inside of a small enclosed room. But they weren't, like, big speakers. They were tiny speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just interesting little things like that that he would try just to see what would happen. But the company Dolby Sound, of course, now makes, like, some of the best audio equipment on earth. Maybe not, like, you know, amplifiers or anything like that, but some of the best headphones that have ever been created. Some of the best, like, speaker systems that have ever been created. I mean, surround sound is still just an amazing thing. And it's, you know, it's, yeah. So Dolby did some pretty amazing things as far as the technology is concerned.
The original Dolby tech, like the original Dolby sound system, was a speaker enclosure that would, had two speakers facing each other that would bounce the sound of a record's hiss against itself to cancel out. So it's a noise canceling system.
Yes.
So you could listen to an album without the clicks and pops. And,
science.
You know, from there.
I was going to say, that's very, very brilliant to come up with that technology,
and
too.
What kills me is, like, so analog. Like, you just literally have the sound itself canceling itself. It's like...
Yeah. Well, yeah, because you figured out the science behind it. It wasn't just like a digital plug-in something.
Yeah.
You actually figured out the science of noise cancellation. That's cool.
All right, moving on to September 13th. Go ahead and do this one, Jake. It is your patriotic duty.
Apparently. 1814. During an attack by the British regulars on the rebel base at Fort McHenry, a 35-year-old Francis Scott Key sits with fellow prisoner exchange Colonel John Stuart Skinner aboard the HMS Tunnett, and they watch all night as His Majesty's fleet pounds Fort McHenry with artillery and cannon fire. Upon seeing the flag still flying over Fort McHenry in the morning, Mr. Key asks for a quill and ink and pen down the poem Defense of Fort McHenry.
Starts off like this. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light?
Never heard it.
I was going to say, better known as...
Our national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner.
Yes, Star-Spangled Banner.
It wasn't put to music until much later, though.
Yes.
So, and it was put to music to an old bar tune.
It wasn't an Irish drinking song?
Something like that.
Yeah.
As we Americans are so proud of doing, we put it to a bar song. Of course, it's a lot better than the other patriotic song where basically we just stole the British national anthem and we're like, no, we're going to put in our own words.
Why not?
Because that's what we do.
I mean, any, like, you know, UK listener would point out that Fort McHenry was a British fort.
Yes.
So when people talk about the defiance of the, you know, American soldiers in there, they were fighting from a very poor, well-built British fort. And to that, I say, you can bite my fat American ass.
USA. Yeah. USA.
No, I just, I get so tired of like fighting with Brits over the majesty of the British Empire. It's like, you know, you were doing blackface like into the 80s, so don't even, sit on your throne of morality.
Well, let's not start another Revolutionary War here, Jacob.
No, it's all in good fun, laddie.
The British invasion was just a music thing.
Yeah. I'd also like to point out that we as Americans were very good at stealing another song that became a quintessential American song, Yankee Doodle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like because how we were getting made fun of.
Yeah, because the phrase, you know, Yankee Doodle went to town, you know, riding on a pony, stuck a feather in his hat and called it macaroni, of which growing up as a child makes no sense
whatsoever.
We're like, why in the world would he call it macaroni? Macaroni is a pasta that you eat with cheese. And it took me a while, but I finally figured it out that macaroni actually was a common phrase back then, which meant a good thing or a stylish thing.
Fancy hat, essentially.
And so saying, you know, Yankee Doodle, this dumb American riding down this road with, you know, sticking a feather in his cap and thinking that he's fancy now because he's got a feather in his cap. The song is a total slight on Americans.
Yes.
And yet we freaking took it and owned it.
That's because those highfalutin sumbitches over on the continent of Europe didn't understand what was important to colonists.
And that was fashion.
Was not fashion. The same way as, like, you know, George Washington having wooden teeth was propaganda. And, like, all the, like, you know, colonials were like, hey, he's got grit.
Yeah.
He's a tough guy. Actually, didn't have wooden teeth. A lot of people tell you he had ivory teeth. Actually, turns out that's not true either. They were teeth from slaves.
Yeah,
so
they were real.
It's even darker than that, and a really terrible footnote in U.S. history. So yep. Glad I brought that up.
All right, let's move on.
So much for the Star-Spangled Banner. Yeah, what's next? Yeah. All right.
So 1941, born on this day, one of my favorite singers in rock history, David Clayton Thomas from Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Of course, had many, many hits, including Spinning Wheel and You've Made Me So Very Happy. They also did a great cover of God Bless the Child. That's amazing. But Spinning Wheel, of course, is a song that will always be ingrained into my memory just from the first line of the song. Because you go, what goes up must come down. Spinning wheel, spinning round.
I feel like I hear you sing this song every week.
No, that's not true.
I've heard you do the what goes up.
Yeah, that's just because I like that. Honestly, David Clayton Thomas, one of my all-time favorite singers in rock history.
And Walking in Memphis is another one he pulls out of his
pocket. That is not true. I never
do that. I could go back, but I won't because it requires effort.
You could go back and listen, and you might find it twice in the last year.
If you know what?
No, just for you.
I'll let you call my bluff.
When
on that
I was
one,
walking in Memphis.
Come on, to the gates of Graceland. Anyway, 1959.
Speaking of Graceland,
1959, Elvis meets Priscilla
Beaulieu. I don't know how to say that.
I don't either. It's French, and they do this thing.
It looks like
below.
Like the same way they do ears. And I can't. Anyway, he met his wife in Germany while he was stationed there.
Who was a child?
A German child.
I'm trying to lighten up this show. We just went from slave teeth.
That is true.
In the mouth of a sitting president.
That is true.
I am trying to lighten this up. Can we not bring the fact the age of consent has been moving up in history?
That is true.
All right.
That's a good thing.
1964, Liverpool's Empire Club hires 24 rugby players to keep the crowd off the stage as the Rolling Stones play. Liverpool must think very highly of rugby players because they thought that 24 men could create a functional human shield against 5,000 attendees. They couldn't.
That reminds me of the time that Hell's Angels got hired to do security.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was out in California. They were like, we can just hire the Hell's Angels instead of actual security.
Yeah.
Like they did at Woodstock.
The only problem is when the Hell's Angels actually beat people in the head. Like
Altamont. Altamont was the name of the town.
Was that it?
That was the name of the town, yeah. I don't remember what the name of the festival was.
Yeah, that was a disaster.
Yeah, it was.
Because they tried to basically recreate Woodstock, and it did not happen.
No, people were getting hit in the head with pipes. It was not a good...
It's like, here, I'm going to tell you this first of all. It doesn't matter. Woodstock, upstate New York. Weather was probably pretty decent, just you know, despite the rain, but it was probably not like super hot, probably wasn't super cold.
Yeah.
Everything was pretty cool. You stick these people in freaking California... And it's friggin' hot out there sometimes. And it's like just like it was gonna be a disaster no matter what they did. So
in reading for this story, right? So like the Rolling Stones had a couple highly publicized concerts where people had gotten like injured in the crowd from them rushing the stage
and mosh pits, yeah,
just getting crushed because people would just run the stage.
Yes.
So they hired these rugby players and the idea was to have them stand in the aisles and just keep people from getting out of their seats into the aisles. Well, you know, people can climb over seats, too.
Yeah.
There's 5,000 of them.
Yeah, yes.
We're going to get an entire rugby club. I don't know why I'm doing the not quite Charlton Heston voice for this, but...
See, now that's the funny thing is that, you know, I mean, if you go to any concert now, like, there's a group of security.
Yes.
You know, like, a few guys that are standing in the front. But for the most part, nobody tries to jump the fence
unless it's
a crazy person. So, it's like, I don't know, there's like a level of respect... I think, for the most part, that's like, oh, hey, we shouldn't cross this line, you know, but they also have, like, that rail now, too.
Yeah.
It's, like, to kind of help separate everything, but what cracks me up is at the big festivals, where it's, like, this super tall stage,
and then
there's, like, 20 feet in between the stage and the crowd.
Yeah.
That just cracks me up. Because then it's like, oh, I'm performing to these people who are like 20 feet away from me now.
Yeah, well, it's annoying when that empty space in between is a bunch of people just like kind of casually strolling around. Like, you know, like they're VIP, but they're not there for that band.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go ahead and move on. 1965. Paul McCartney's songs Yesterday was released by the Beatles as a single in the U.S. McCartney's vocal and acoustic guitar together with a string quartet essentially made for the first solo performance of the band. And actually that is true because it's the one Beatles song that was released that is only credited to Paul McCartney.
Mm-hmm.
The final recording was so different from the other works of the Beatles that the band members vetoed the release of the song as a single in the United Kingdom. But in some weird way, it was eventually released as a single in 1976. Because that makes perfect sense.
11 years later.
Yeah.
So, there you go. But yeah, that's, of course, Yesterday is one of the most covered songs on Earth.
Yeah.
And, of course, Blackbird being another one that's, like, really covered a lot. But yeah, Yesterday at one point in time was, like, the most covered song on Earth.
I like it.
I'm not sure if it still is, because I'm pretty sure some... Mm-hmm. There's a few Christian songs out there that have been covered by a thousand different
they
other
count.
Artists.
Yeah, right.
So, there you
they
go.
They don't count because you couldn't, like a Christian group couldn't cover, Love Pipe by the Red Elvises.
That's true.
hey, 1969.
You're going to love this one.
I don't know who this
Great,
is.
Great, give it to us. You're going to love this.
Kim... Fowley?
Sure, we'll say Fowley.
Takes to the stage at the Toronto Rock and Roll Revival and asks the crowd to hold up their lighters for Eric Clapton and John Lennon.
Why?
Let that sink in for a second.
Eric Clapton?
Lighters. Because no one had done it until then.
So, really?
So that was the first time.
That was the birthplace of the lighter at the rock festival?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Put up your cigarette
Jake,
lighters.
You win this week. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I love
buddy.
It. That's good.
So thank you for the Toronto Rock Revival organizer, Kim Fowley.
Boom.
Love
that
you,
was
girl.
Amazing. Jake, honestly, that's like the greatest little fact this week.
Thank you. There
that's,
we go.
That's like one of those essential pieces of music history that has nothing to do with music,
yeah.
But yet it's so important.
Yeah. I mean, you have apps on phones because people don't smoke anymore.
And so you just have the lighter,
yeah.
The Zippo
yeah.
on your phone
I, yeah,
screen?
I used to have one that was a Zippo. When you shake the phone sideways, it opens and closes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen that.
The one that I had, if you blew into the microphone, it actually blew the fire out.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
cool.
So there you go. Let's move on up to 1977.
Oh, this is a me one because it's in here just for me.
Go ahead.
So 1977, got to wish a happy birthday to one of my favorite artists of all time, Fiona Apple.
Yeah.
The singer, the songwriter, the big voice in a little package. Happy birthday, Fiona. Thanks for the music.
And 5 years later,
yes,
one of the greatest podcasters that I've ever known is also born. And that is our very own Jake.
Oh, well, thank you, Brian. There we go.
So it's not your birthday when we're recording this.
No, it's not.
But happy birthday on
hey,
the show.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, happy birthday, Jake.
No, you're destroying the third wall, Brian.
Dun, dun,
Everyone
dun.
Listening has to think that this is live. We're performing just for you in whatever venue you're in.
Well, I mean, you can't expect it's a podcast. People get it whenever they want. Somebody could be listening to this right. a month from now.
Somebody will listen to this like a year from now. It'll still be relevant,
I guess.
If you're listening to this on September 13th, please comment on our Facebook page at Follow the Sound in the group and wish Jake a happy birthday very belatedly.
Oh. how sweet.
So let's move on from there to something very, very sad. And of course, we talked about this last week. 1996, September 13th, Tupac Shakur died after being shot. Of course, we talked about it last week. So it was 6 days before that he was shot. 13 bullets were fired into the BMW, and the incident was blamed on the East and West Coast gang wars. Shakur was actually a convicted sex offender, guilty of sexual abuse, but he served 11 months of his sentence, and he was released from prison on an appeal financed by Marion Suge Knight, the CEO of Death Row Records. So he definitely had his problems, but at the same time, that dude produced some phenomenal music. But then again, I mean, we also talk about Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley. So, I mean, yeah. So they had their problems.
There is a very long storied history of debauchery in the music industry. And actually, I think it's going on even to this day with the whole child pornography scandals that are kind of starting to come to light mm-hmm. in the music industry.
Hey, look, as a debaucherous lecher, I am offended that you would bring debauchery into
my vocabulary.
Yes, at this moment, and include child pornography in that. I mean, that is just...
How about we move on? I don't want to talk about child pornography.
Well, all right, fine.
That's pretty depressing, even for our levels of depression.
No, it's bad. It's just that it's just showing that there's a trend here in the music industry that it's dark. It's very dark.
Yeah, there is a lot of darkness that goes on in the music industry.
Well, there's a lot of lonely people in the music industry.
There's a lot of messed up people. Yeah. But the problem is that those messed up peoples are what cause a lot of great art to be made.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right.
I mean, you look back at some of the greatest musicians or even just the greatest artists ever, and most of them are extremely flawed.
Well, how many tormented souls have we lost recently even, you know? I mean, you go back and listen to the music and you say, oh my gosh, they were trying to tell us. You know, and we just think it's real deep, meaningful music, but it's real people confessing their real feelings.
Yeah.
And pouring it out there, and then it's like, how did we miss it?
Yeah, exactly. So, let's see.
I got this.
Go ahead.
2013, Victor Willis, lead singer of the Village People and chief songwriter for the group, regained copyright of 33 songs he wrote for the Village People. It's the first case that was ever filed on a 1978 law that made a legal road for artists to regain control of their work after 35 years. And to date, it's the only case to side with the artist.
The only case to side with the artist?
Now, there's a lot of cases that haven't been very high profile, and that's probably why. Because this was the first one to get in, it's probably the reason it went with the artist. There's speculation that Paul McCartney will be coming up for a couple songs, you know, some music now, trying to regain control of that. But who knows?
Wow.
Well, you know, what's funny about the whole Paul McCartney thing is that for a good while there, Michael Jackson, the Michael Jackson estate owned a bunch of the Beatles music. And the reason why Michael Jackson owned a bunch of the Beatles music is because a bit before that, Michael Jackson asked Paul McCartney, hey, What is something that I should do to help me invest some money and do those types of things? And he goes, oh, you should buy the rights to some music. And then Michael Jackson went and bought basically all the rights to the Beatles.
Okay, why not?
Yeah. So it was McCartney's
fault. Now, I know that someone is sitting down and thinking right now. They're like, wait a second. Victor Willis' 35 years were up before Paul McCartney's. The Village People were a 70s group. The Beatles were a 50s and 60s group. How does that work? Well, the Beatles, Apple Records, sold their rights.
Yes.
Years after the Beatles had quit making music. So that's where that 35 year of after you sold your stuff, you can regain the rights. Mm-hmm. Thing comes into play. So we'll see what happens with that. We're a couple years away from it.
That we are. Moving on to September 14th. 1955, Little Richard entered a New Orleans recording studio to begin 2 days of recording. Things were not going well, and during a break, Richard and his producer, Bumps Blackwell, went to the Dewdrop Inn for lunch. Richard started playing the piano in the bar like crazy, singing a loud and lewd version of Tutti Frutti. With only 15 minutes left in the session, Little Richard recorded the song and coined the phrase "a wop bop a loo bop blop bam boom."
Mm.
Which is just fantastic.
Which kind of was the thing that really like launched him into superstardom anyway, which is still just funny.
But I suspect that if I sat down to have like a lunch or a beer with Little Richard, that we would have got along swimmingly.
I'm sure.
Because just noise for no reason is one of my pastimes.
Yeah, it's funny. The song was almost written like on Tourette's or something.
That's terrible.
Well, no, but just the story here.
Yeah.
That's not terrible. I'm not trying to be insulting to anybody, but it just sounds like he sat down and just blurted something out.
Yeah. I do wonder if the lewd version is anything remotely close to what actually ended up recorded.
I know, right?
Because I could understand some of them. Like, you know, I got a girl named Sue who knows just what to do. Like, I mean, that's you know, more like an innuendo. But Tutti Frutti Oh Rudy, like that, I mean, that doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, so it makes me wonder if his, if the lewd version was like really, really bad.
I got a guy named Buck. He knows just how to.
He got himself a truck.
But let's go ahead and move on from that craziness to just another sad and depressing moment. 1968, Roy Orbison's house in Nashville burnt down, which, you know, you normally think, well, I mean, it was just a house. What's the big deal? Unfortunately, his two eldest sons died in the blaze. I don't actually know, like, what surrounded the event, like how it actually happened. But I do know that Roy Orbison was on tour in the UK at the time of the incident. And it's just sad to know that, you know, he was out there doing his thing. And then he, you know, just gets word. It's like, your house burned down. Your two sons are dead.
And you have, like, tons of show dates.
But, yeah. And that's actually what they said, is that he took time off, you know, for the funeral and like all that kind of stuff. But a few weeks later, he was back to touring. And I can understand it. A lot of people would be like, well, that's kind of insensitive. But I mean, like some of the times it's like when you're an artist like that, the best thing you can do is just go back to work.
Well, for anyone really. Sometimes
doing something is better than just sitting around.
Sometimes
when your
soul is completely crushed, just being a machine is the best option.
Yeah, and I guarantee that there were some of those nights when he was performing up on stage and he was crying, literally crying.
The thing that's really odd to me is it just shows you the difference in the culture at the time with the media. Because in 1968, you might have had like a story in a local paper in your hometown.
Yes.
You know, like somewhere in Nashville that might have run a story, you know, about, hey, you know, this happened and his sons perished and they're remembered by this and that and everything. But, you know, today it would be a news, like, I mean, it'd be a media blitz.
Oh,
yeah. And everyone would want to know, like, was it the wiring? Who can be blamed for this?
Oh, yeah. It would be a week later that you'd have.
How could this tragedy happen?
How
could
Roy
to blame?
Houses safer. Would they have survived if Roy Orbison had been at home?
Well, like, is Roy to blame? That seems more like a mid-90s Montel Williams episode than like legit media, but yeah.
I feel like that's TMZ or something too.
Well, God, TMZ.
Roy to blame? Why was he on tour?
It's like we caught up with Roy Orbison at an airport. How are you feeling after the death of your two sons? Does it hurt?
Yeah.
Really?
And then you wonder why these artists like smash their cameras stuff.
Yeah.
It's a different age. It is a very different age. So, but let's go ahead and move on. We have a birthday, of course, in this day and age. 1983, born on this day, Amy Winehouse, of course, the singer, the songwriter, who had a massive success in the UK and in America and around the world, has been influencing young female singers for years now, even after her death, where she so tragically died of a drug overdose. Yeah. She recorded a ton of songs. I remember the first time I actually saw an Amy Winehouse video, and it was Rehab.
Yeah.
And our good friend John Geiler showed me the video. And he's like, hey, you got to check this out. So I watched it and I was like, holy cow, like this girl can sing. Like she can belt out these tones. And I thought it was fantastic. And then, of course, afterwards, like, you know, a couple of years down the road, after every single female artist that was showing up after her sounded like her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It was like, okay. It's like this is one of those clear signs of somebody who was doing something original, and then the music industry just latched onto and absolutely. Ruined it all.
That's what I was going to say. Was she did. She brought back kind of that soulful crooner-esque feel.
The other thing that she did was that right after that time, when she started making it big, of course, another British act, Lily Allen, was also making a name for herself. And then shortly after that, Adele, and then a slew of British artists started showing up again, and the next British invasion started.
Yeah. And it was with big, powerful female voices.
Big, powerful vocalists.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like, people can talk about, like, Ed Sheeran and stuff, even, like, you know, being sort of the folky singer that he is. Dude still has a powerful voice whenever he wants to use it.
You know, I would even say that, like, because you know how Lady Gaga's got two sides to her. She's got a poppy side and she's got a soulful side.
Yes, yes.
And I feel like her soulful side is an Amy Winehouse reincarnation.
Kind of, yeah.
You know?
Similar. But let's move on to somebody else who has another power.
Can I just
go?
Say,
yeah, go ahead. Okay. Sorry.
So Rehab, as a song, I had heard the name of it said a lot of times, and you know, when we get back from commercial break, we're gonna play this. And I was really just kind of hated pop music, mm-hmm. like at the time, just where it was. And so I just thought, oh, this is you know another trash act from whatever. And then finally, when I did hear it, I was so blown away.
Yeah, it didn't sound like any of the other pop songs, did it?
Like, I mean, it was clearly not blues, you know, or clearly not jazz. But at the same time, it just probably because I love Brian's dad so much, the big voice and small package thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's such a comforting kind of homey place for me to be.
I think and that song specifically, which, you know, because that was kind of the big single that introduced to a lot of people, especially here in the U.S., was that kind of drum beat with it, the, you know, kind of the brushes instead of the sticks on the drums.
Yeah.
And then also like that baritone saxophone kind of doing like, but it did have that swing, but they had, you know, brass and like the ensemble too. So it wasn't, you know, studio produced pop music. It was like a real band playing very old yet fresh. You know, like you said, I don't know what is that genre? It's kind of like a soulful, bluesy. I don't know, what would you call it?
Yeah, I don't know.
Crooner-esque.
I mean,
yeah,
sure. I mean, that's
maybe big, not really big band, but still with the full
but
band,
jazzy,
you know?
Bluesy.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? I'm just gonna coin the phrase right here. Right, London blues.
I'll call it that.
You got your Chicago blues, right? You got your
That's kind of cool.
Got your Delta blues.
Yeah, yeah, your Delta blues. That's London blues right there.
Cool.
Big band, kind of pop.
I like it.
I dig it.
That'll be our follow the sound phrase of the night.
London
there
blues.
There you go. You want to take this one, Brian? 2008?
Yeah, sure. I got this one. So 2008, of course, as I said, another large singer out there. Kings of Leon started a three-week run at number one on the UK singles chart with Sex on Fire. Now, this is the funny thing about this is that like they became huge on the UK charts way before they became huge on the US charts.
Yeah.
They were big all around the frickin' world except in the US. Like, and it just cracks me up. Like, they had, you know, like three albums before that album.
Yeah.
And like they were all huge, just not in America. And then Sex on Fire and Use Somebody comes out and they become massive in the U.S.
And how quick did they blow up big?
It was very, very fast.
It was like overnight that Kings of Leon became the biggest band in America.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So there you go. 2008, Kings of Leon, of course, became even bigger in the U.K.
Yeah.
And then shortly after, became huge in America.
They had like six or seven songs on the Hot 100 all at one time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they did. Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
And they had the Sex on Fire, they did the version from, what was it, the X Factor? That was like the single?
Yeah.
That live studio, it was like the live studio version.
I always preferred You Somebody, but that's just me.
That's another band I was dismissive of, like really early on. Probably because I just didn't like the person that was like trying to introduce them to me.
Yeah, you just weren't listening to them.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it would be like if Milo Yiannopoulos came up to you and was like, hey, I got this new whatever album you got to listen to. You'd be really dismissive of it.
I
get that.
Right. Yeah.
But I know that I ended up buying that album because I'd heard those two songs and I was like, yeah, sure, I'll pick this up. Why not? And it really floored me how good it was.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of great songs on that album. So, which of course was called Only by the Night, of which, if you know anything about Kings of Leon song or album titles, they always have, like five syllables. Only okay. By the Night.
There's probably a science to that.
Aha, Shake, Heartbreak.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've heard there's some weird things.
Even Walls, we all love songs.
Yeah.
We all like love songs. That's what it's called. Mm. They always have five syllables for every album that they've ever done.
It rolls off the tongue well, though.
That is true. All right, moving on to September 15th. 1965, the Ford Motor Company became the first automaker to offer an 8-track tape player as an option for their entire line of vehicles on sale in the U.S. Tapes were initially only available at auto parts stores as home 8-track equipment was still a year away.
Yeah, I can see that because if you already own records, you know, like 8-tracks. Unless you're using it in an automobile, it's not any more convenient than having a record player.
Yeah, you might as well use your records.
Well,
yeah.
I take it back. Maybe let's say you wanted to DJ your own restaurant. Probably easier to have 8-track tapes and cartridges.
Yeah.
Than to have,
because you just
vinyl.
Press play. Yeah. You don't flip it or anything.
Yeah.
I guess even with tapes, though, depending on the technology, you might still have to flip it.
Yep. That is true.
Because did they have the auto flip when that first came out?
No, they had the chunker.
Probably not, right?
You had the chunker.
Yeah.
The little switch that you flip up and down.
You still had to flip album sides.
Anyway.
But it was portable, and that's the key.
Yes.
That's the biggest key to all of this.
I can't, man. Okay, being a delivery driver by day, or sometimes by night as well, I can't imagine like driving around and not being able to choose what I want to listen to. It's like torture.
Like driving in silence it sometimes feels really good. But if that was the only option, it would be mind-numbing.
It's not the silence, Greg. It's like when I'm out in Des Moines, Illinois, and my choices of radio station is listening to the broadcast of the high school football game or Catholic radio. It's like, oh, okay, so I can hear somebody chant, you know, Hail Mary.
And it's not even a clear signal.
Yeah, and it's AM radio in Des Moines, Illinois. Like, ugh.
Well, thank goodness Ford Motor Company put music in the vehicles.
That is true. All right, moving on up to 1970. Jake, I put this one in here just for you. U.S. Vice President Spiro Agnew said in a speech that the youth of America were being brainwashed into drug culture by rock music, movies, books, and underground newspapers.
You know, just that term, rock music, sounds so fuddy-duddy, doesn't it?
Yeah,
that
it does.
Is true.
You just say rock and roll.
Yeah.
Anyway,
That rock music.
We've heard that narrative and documented it forever.
I just think it's funny that Spiro Agnew did it.
Okay.
I also think it's funny when they use the phrase.
Vice president.
Yeah.
It's like not even the president, just the vice president. She's like, these kids just listening to their rock music. Mm-hmm. Getting into them drugs.
I like, too, how they say they're being brainwashed into it, but yet
they're
like
you.
Moths to a flame over rock and roll.
Those kids
I don't know.
Are just brought in here like a moth to the flame.
I don't think anybody had to be convinced to listen to the rock.
Just the rock music is brainwashing our children these days.
Agnew!
Not like the good, clean music that we used to listen to when we were kids.
Yeah.
Is that your Richard
Tommy
Nixon?
Dorsey Orchestra and...
Nobody ever.
Acker Bilk.
Nobody ever. Nobody ever tried to do drugs in the back of a car when they were listening to Buddy Rich and his orchestra. Nobody ever did that.
You don't think so?
No.
Look, I guarantee you somebody out there has put on the Buddy...
smoking those marijuana cigarettes.
Tommy Dorsey Orchestra and shot heroin. I guarantee you that's happened. Probably a really good time.
Nobody ever thought Miles Davis was doing drugs.
You don't think people...
Oh, well, how little you knew, Spiro.
There you
how
go.
How little you knew.
Oh, man.
All right. Let's go ahead and move on to this next wonderful thing. In 1990, Wilson Phillips scored their second U.S. number one with Release Me, and their number 36 hit in the U.K. But the group was made up of Carney and Wendy Wilson, the daughters of the Beach Boys leader, Brian Wilson, along with China Phillips, the daughter of the Mamas and Papas founder, John Phillips.
I'll tell you right now.
There you go.
If you want to get an entire room of women singing in unison, put on some Wilson Phillips, done. Done.
Agreed.
Wedding DJ says done.
It took me a very long time to actually realize that those were the daughters of those, like, just high level, you know, rock history guys. So
It's interesting.
Like, and I'm a big Brian Wilson fan. The name Wilson didn't even click with me.
Yeah.
So
is that the
because Wilson's
guy?
Such a common name, yeah. So it's like it never dawned on me that they could actually be like the children of. But let's close out the show with this final little fact. In 1994, a reel-to-reel tape of the Quarrymen appearing at St. Peter's Parish Church Garden Party in Liverpool in July 1957 sold for £69,000 or $125,000 at Sotheby's auction.
Wow. A reel-to-reel tape
of a Quarrymen recording. I'd actually really like to listen to it. I think that would be fascinating.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
I love those stories where somebody finds a priceless artifact at, like, a bake sale or the basement of a parish.
That's like the woman bought, like, a $1 teacup that was worth, like, $1 million at a garage sale.
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking of, like, the silent film Metropolis, how there were, like two reels out of eight reels that were in existence until somebody found... like, you know, four countries over, like not even in Germany, found a print of it, you know, like in Plainsfield, Massachusetts or something.
Yeah. And that's what's kind of funny is that there were a bunch of these like movies, even just like that, like all the copies were completely destroyed except for one in the middle of BFE. And like that some guy at some local theater just like kept a print of it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't destroyed.
Wow.
Just, it's amazing how many times that actually happens.
We had that story about Buddy Holly where his blood-covered glasses stayed in a small-town Iowa police department in like their evidence lockbox for like, what was it, 60 years?
It was a good long while, I know that much. Huh. But, yeah.
Oh, yeah, here we go. I pulled up Metropolis. They actually found a like 80% intact reel in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Wow. Yep.
You know.
Yeah.
It's like, crazy, that's amazing, huh? Yeah.
So that's it. That's all we got for you today for this week in music history. Of course, like we said before, if you want to help out the show, you can go to the website and click on the Amazon banner, do all of that fun stuff. We get a little bit of money back. Doesn't cost you anything extra. Or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Of course, we want to thank lineupmedia.fm for allowing us to put on the show. Go to lineupmedia.fm and check out all of the great programs that we have on there. Tons of different things that you could possibly want to listen to, 1,000 different topics, including things like parenting food allergies, which is all about being a parent and raising a child with food allergies. Armenia Proud, which is all about dedicated to being a proud Armenian. Although I am not Armenian, I still love actually listening to that show and producing it. And I am on with the host a lot of times talking about different things. So you can go check out those great shows. You can find other great ones on lineupmedia.fm. And for this week in music history, I, of course, have been your host, Brian Kroc. And along with me has been Jacob Crum.
You don't do heavy metal in Dublin.
And, of course, Greg Harvey.
Wop, bop, a loo, bop, a wop, bam, boom.
And remember, if you hear it, follow the sound. We'll be right back.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.